You are listening to Podski Wee Wee, a proud member of the Canadian Football Podcast Network.
Over the middle, caught Saunders, Jalen Saunders, touchdown.
Harris to the end zone.
Mazzoli chased down, end zone, touchdown, Luke Tasker. Into tight traffic, this looks like it's picked, it is picked by Richard Leonard.
On second down, Mazzoli looks for Banks in deep, and Banks makes the catch, touchdown. Beats two Ottawa defenders of the football, Pruno and Rowe. And Banks has his second touchdown catch of the game.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
Mike, we got to start the show this week talking about one of us getting into a little trouble for one of our opinions. Normally that's me with my platform over at Three Down Nation. I'm usually the one who's taken heat for some opinions, especially when people like Henry Burris call me thin-skinned for daring to come at him for his opinions. But anyway, it's not me this week that got the ire of a CFL player. It was you. Why don't you tell everyone who's maybe not tuned in as to what actually happened with you and one James Wilder Jr. of the Toronto Argonauts?
Well, you know, when James Wilder Jr. was going through the contract dispute this offseason, I was the guy that said, you need to sign this guy. You need to pay him what he's worth. You know, give him some extra money. Get him back on your team because he's an important guy. But then and I still believe that. But the more and more I think about it, I think there's going to be a drop-off this season for James Wilder Jr. I think that teams are going to be way more prepared for him. They're going to stack the box. They're going to try and stop this guy. And I believe they're going to try to take him away and make Ricky Ray throw the ball. Because if you send pressure and stop Wilder, you're going to send pressure on Ray as well. And that's the way to get at the Toronto Argonauts. So I tweeted out that I don't believe James Wilder Jr., will get 1,000 yards receiving or 1,000 yard rushing this season. Neither will happen. And he got back to me. And I did not expect that because, you know, who am I? And he just, you know, he was very polite. He was very cool about it. And, you know, I respect that. He thinks that I'm wrong. And he's right to think that. I mean, players have to be ultra confident to succeed, but he basically put it to me this way. You don't think I can average 14 yards each quarter. So that's what the numbers bear out to if he's going to get 1,000 yard rushing season and 1,000 yard receiving season. Now, what do you think about that, Josh?
Well, when you put it in such low terms, you think, well, yeah, he's going to do it. Now, to be fair, he said 14 yards per quarter. He meant 14 each. He meant 28 total yards per quarter because he's going to need to average 14 rushing yards and 14 receiving yards per quarter to reach 1,000 on the season, not just 14 yards total because that's not nowhere. That'd be 7 yards. You can't rush for 28 yards and receive for 28 yards per game and get to 1,000 after 18 games. That's not how it works. That said, when you boil it down like that, you think, well, yeah, like that doesn't sound so hard. But then you think about it. No one else has ever done it. That's how I kind of look at it. Like, yes, he's right in that he's an elite player and probably should be able to average those yards per quarter. But no one in the history of the CFL has ever done it. It's probably going to happen eventually. I think he has a shot to do it. I'm not saying he won't. I'm not saying he will. He's a pretty talented player. And I think we saw it last year when given the opportunity, he can really run the ball, really catch the ball. He had some darn impressive games, but no one has ever, and we're talking some great running backs in this league year in and year. Andrew Harris came pretty close last year, and I think Andrew Harris is probably a better receiving back than James Wilder Jr. is, but that's my personal opinion. So I get where he's coming from because the numbers seem so low, but yet you look at the history of the league and I'll name you off the guys that have done it. There was silence there for a reason. So You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And you look at his numbers in the playoffs. Okay, he had one playoff game against the Saskatchewan Roughriders. Rushing, 14 carries, 52 yards, 3.7 yard average. Same game, receiving a reception, 52 yards. Let's do the math here, 14, 28. That is below 14 yards for each category, right?
Yep.
And then if you look at his Grey Cup numbers, they're even worse.
Which is weird, right? Because you would think in the Grey Cup, with the inclement weather, that the Argos right. would have been inclined to run the football more or to use the short passing game. Yet in that game, they had a 100-yard touchdown reception. Ricky Ray played fantastically. Like, you would think that he would have been in the game plan more, but you're about to give the numbers, so let's hear him. Because I, off the top of my head, recalling the game, I remember him being almost a complete non-factor.
Well, you'd be right on that. Here are his rushing yards in the most important game of the season. 9 carries, 13 yards. That's a 1.4 yard average.
Well, that's look that, it is. 13 that's, yards that's per his, game is definitely not yeah. 14 per quarter.
No. Let's look at his receiving yards. 2 receptions, 18 yards. So in the most important game of the year, James Wilder was a non-factor. He scored a touchdown, yes, on like a one-yard plunge. He barely got in. Listen, I think that he's going to get a dose of reality this season. Now, I could be wrong. He could. I'm probably going to be wrong on the 1,000 yards rushing. He's probably going to get over 1,000 yard rushing. But I don't think I'm going to be wrong on the 1,000 yards receiving. He's just not that good of a receiver out of the backfield.
Well, you crunch those numbers. I crunch some different numbers. And I went and looked at his season totals from 2017. And for the season, he averaged 7.8 receiving yards per quarter and 12.8 rushing yards per quarter. That's over 17 games. It says on CFL website, and it said in the stats that I have, that he played in 17 games. Now, he didn't start 17 games. He didn't see a lot of action early on, but those are his numbers over a full season. Those are pretty respectable numbers, to be honest with you. He got the number, like he had 500 and something yards receiving and 800 and something yards rushing in 17 games. You think he'll get a little bit more volume. You could see those going to maybe 1,100 yards, maybe 1,000 to 1,100 yards rushing, maybe somewhere in the 7 to 800 yards receiving category. Now, you look at his numbers after Labor Day, and they're a lot more impressive. 15.9 right. yards per quarter rushing or receiving and 23.9 yards per quarter rushing after Labor Day. But again, yeah. you also look at those numbers. You mentioned I didn't include the playoffs since I just included the regular season games. But then you look at his numbers and you go, okay, that's great. But he was kind of a new entity. No one really knew what to expect. And he had some yeah. massive games. We all remember the 190-yard game against the Eskimos. And we all remember the week after that where he had a big game then. But then he came into Hamilton, and I think he had less than 50 yards rushing in that game. Like, I feel like he can get used, but it also seems like, and I think your numbers from the playoffs spell this out, he can kind of get lost in the offense. And it's no different than any of the elite backs in this league. With the exception of really Andrew Harris, you kind of see running backs get lost in the shuffle. One of the best all-around backs in CFL played in Hamilton for a number of years, and that's CJ Gable. And he never came close to achieving 1,000 because he wasn't used, right?
Yeah.
And now Edmonton gets used a little bit more. But again, there are times, especially when you have an elite quarterback, and the Argos have one of those, where he's going to get on a hot streak and they're going to ignore Wilder for 10 minutes of game time. Like, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with Wilder's skill set. It's just how teams are scheming.
Game situations.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And do you really want to take the ball to Ricky Ray's hands all that much? Like, you mentioned the Grey Cup. You said he had 9 rushes and 2 receptions. That's 11 touches. Like, that's kind of like, and you got to remember, like, that big game he had against Edmonton where he had 190 yards rushing, he only had like 11 or 14 rushes in that game. Like, he just had some big right. runs. And I know you can't just say, well, take the big runs away, and he does, but they count just as much as any other carry. But his numbers are a little skewed. Like, again, I'm not trying to downplay the success he had. I saw someone come at you and ask you if you were still angry about the Argos winning the Grey Cup, which is like, we're grown men. That was November. I don't know about you, but it didn't bother me. I picked the Argos to win. And you've said a few times you were actually cheering for Toronto to win that Grey Cup. We're not bothered. This is not a Ticat Argo thing. I'm not sure. Andrew Harris, to me, is the one player that I would say has the capabilities. CJ Gable has the talent to do it if given the opportunity, but I don't think any other running back in this league, James Wilder would be third on that list of guys who I think can go for 1K and 1K. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, and neither do I. And you look, you know, Mark Trestman is a pass-happy coach, right? He likes to throw the ball a lot. So this, he could not reach those numbers, but it couldn't be, you know, it could be more of a coaching decisions rather than his play on the field. You know, he couldn't, maybe he doesn't get the ball a lot in certain games, because we see, like we talked about earlier, we see these huge games, you know, 140, 190 yard games, but then we see games where he's only got like 50 yards rushing or 30 yards rushing. So it's all going to depend on the team he's playing, on the schemes the coaches run. So, I mean, for any player, it's going to be tough to have a 1,000 yard season. I mean, you put in, you know, Walter Payton, or, you know, you bring back Mike Pringle and he's in his prime. I don't think they're going to get those numbers. So we'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, aside from Andrew Harris, I think, and this was with Trestman, Avon Coburn came pretty close to 1,000. I think he had 900 of each in a season for the Alouettes. I want to say it was 2010. I could be wrong. Anyone out there wants to fact check me on that, please do. But he came close to 1,000. But you also have to stay healthy for 18 games. Yeah. And that's not a given either, especially at the running back position. James Wilder Jr. was not the starting running back for the Argos to start the season. It was Brandon Whitaker. Brandon Whitaker got hurt. James Wilder Jr. comes into the lineup and takes his spot. That's what happens in football. Yes, he's got a ton of talent. Yes, he's the reigning rookie of the year. I like him as a player. I enjoy watching him play. He's exciting. But he's not immune to injuries. He's not immune to a slump. And you mentioned the offense. Tommy Condell's the offensive coordinator there. Who was the offensive coordinator in Hamilton? And people can say, it was Ken Austin. It was Ken Austin. Tommy Condell has a very strong personality and worked with Ken Austin before. He's not calling plays. Austin's not letting him call plays that he doesn't think they can run. And the Ticats didn't run a ton when Condell was the offensive coordinator here. So there's a lot of things not necessarily working against James Wilder Jr. And if he goes for 1,000, I won't say I'm surprised, because I think he's got the talent to do it. We've never seen it before. Now, if you watch college basketball, we had never seen a 16 seed beat a 1 seed in the NCAA tournament before. That happened this year. Who knows? Maybe we'll be here at the end of the year going, James Wilder Jr.'s MOP because he's the first ever running back to do 1K, 1K. We'll wait and see. But there a lot of things have to break your way to do something that no one has ever done in the league before. That's kind of where I'll end it with that.
Yeah, and I also think that James Wilder Jr. has made some statements this offseason that may be construed as disrespectful towards defensive players in this league.
He's got a target on his back.
That's what I was just going to say. He's got a target on his back. Players are going to want to smack him in the mouth, and that's just my personal opinion. But, hell of a player. We're just going to have to wait and see if he reaches those numbers.
So it's very rare for you and I to sit down and do a podcast where we have absolutely zero Ticats news. But, Mike, we have absolutely zero Ticats news to discuss. Over the last 3 weeks, the team has done nothing, which is fine. It's that area of the offseason where things don't happen. We will have some Ticats content a little bit later. Yeah, I know you tweeted out we are going to talk about the 1998 East Final, which I'm sure many listeners are going to remember very fondly. But we do have some CFL news to discuss. And since the last time you and I sat down, CFL week in Winnipeg has come and gone. There were a lot of things that happened over the course of the 5 or so days there in Winnipeg. We had a Hall of Fame announced. We had some new rules proposed. We'll get to that in a second. But just your general thoughts of CFL week. This is the second time they did it. It seems like it was just as big a success this time. We've now heard that Edmonton and I believe Hamilton and perhaps even, I think Ottawa, maybe they're all interested in bidding and hosting this again. So clearly the teams in the league see this as being a really viable thing going forward. I didn't follow CFL week a ton because it felt like one of those things where if you're there, you're really into it. But if you're not, it kind of wasn't for you. And I felt that way last year when it was in Regina. But what are your overall thoughts on CFL week? Do you think this is a good thing to have? Do you think this is something that teams should have been on, kind of like the Grey Cup? And we can get this going around places and make it sort of a secondary special event in the off season that can like kind of mimic and mirror what we get with Grey Cup.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing. It gets people talking about the CFL in March when they usually wouldn't be. The funny thing was I was watching Sportsnet and they had Tim and Sid had, they were talking about CFL week. They had Randy Ambrosi on There was an article on Three Down Nation, I believe, by Joel Gassen. Yep. So that's a good thing. Like, there's no way in hell Sportsnet, not any show on Sportsnet, would be talking about CFL week in the past. So I think that's a good thing. I think the whole week is a great thing to have. It's like a mini Grey Cup in the off season. Fans come, they party, they go watch the combine. You know, it's just overall a good thing. I've heard that Winnipeg was a great host. It was, you know, people embraced it in Winnipeg. The Winnipeg's a very good football town. You know, the Jets are number one, but the Bombers are close number two. So there was a lot of interest there. And I think it would be great for, say, Hamilton to get it next year, seeing that it's looks like it's going to be a while before they actually get a Grey Cup. So I think it's a great idea to push this thing around the country to different cities, different CFL markets. And also, I had a great idea, Josh. A great idea.
You have a great idea?
I had a great idea, yeah. How about Halifax for for CFL week?
I don't disagree that that is a great idea, Mike. You are a genius for coming up with that idea.
I know. I stole it. Sorry, Adam. I stole it from you, you know.
No, but that is a good idea. I think the only issue with making CFL week kind of a destination event that it's different from the Grey Cup is that at the end of the week of Grey Cup festivities, you have a game. And I think that's always going to be sort of the draw to Grey Cup. Even if you – like, I went to a Grey Cup in Toronto. I didn't do any of the festivity stuff because that's not really who I am. I guess this Grey Cup I'm going to have to get used to mingling with people because I'm sure you're not going to let me be a hermit and stay in your apartment all week. You're going to make me go out and interact with human beings as much as I'm going to hate you for it. But I'm bracing myself for that. I still have many, many months.
A couple of beers. A couple of beers, you'll loosen up, bud.
But I'm just – again, so – like, but there's always the game. So no matter what happens – during the week, all the hoopla around it. The end of the week, you know you're going to see a football game. The football game. The biggest game of the year, Canadian football-wise. That. So people are – okay, so worst-case scenario, you go to these places. You go to – like, we'll be going to Edmonton this year. Well, I'll be going to Edmonton. You'll be staying in Edmonton. And a lot of people are coming to Edmonton this year for the Grey Cup for the game. CFL week, I don't know if it's as – like, it happened in Regina. It happened in Winnipeg. Two football-mad places. I think because of how close Regina is to Winnipeg, you saw a lot, a very heavy presence of Saskatchewan fans. I think that's good. It's going to be harder when you move it around. I still think they should definitely move it around. I think Hamilton, I think even places like Vancouver. Yes, they don't have a great football culture there right now with the CFL. The Lions attendance is hurting. But what does it hurt to bring something like this there? Because it gets attention and maybe will re-spark or rekindle that fire that fans in BC had for it, because the Stars are there. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like even in the markets like Toronto, like Montreal, that are struggling, this could kind of help buoy support for the league there by showcasing all the great players we have in this league and kind of making it, hey, we're coming here. Come. And I feel like people tend to come around major events around their city. Like, I think when any city kind of hosts something big, the locals are always the most adamant about this will be a great time. We're going to show people why Vancouver is a great city, why Montreal is a great city, why Hamilton is a great city, so on and so forth. So I think maybe even that would be okay. I would love selfishly to see it in Hamilton. We haven't had any major CFL anything here for quite some time. You were living here the last time Hamilton hosted a major CFL event. Mm-hmm. I would love it here for the selfish reasons. I'd like to partake in some of this stuff. It would probably be a lot of fun to go watch the combine or go to the fan fests and do some of that stuff. But the thing that I find the hardest thing I think about selling it to people to travel is that there's no real like main event. Like the Grey Cup has a game. CFL week kind of just has a thing. So it might be a tougher sell if you take it out some of these football hotbeds, but I still think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm not sure, you know, you say you bring the Stars in, but BC and Toronto and Montreal, they're not Stars to them. They don't, you know,
well,
SJ Green isn't a star, you know, Tom Brady's a star, whoever in the NFL is a star. CFL players aren't stars to these people.
Maybe, okay, I won't disagree with you, but I will go to an old Vince McMahonism and we like to talk about wrestling on this show. You called out Vince McMahon last week. Has he tweeted back at you yet?
Oh, we had a private conversation. I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, okay. No problem. You bring a guy in as a main eventer, and the crowd will respect him and believe in him as a main eventer. If CFL Week goes to Toronto and there's billboards everywhere, maybe that's the type of thing that you need to get people to finally see these athletes as the superstars they are. And this, to me, CFL Week is kind of low stakes. When it, like, it's not like, oh, it's a, the Grey Cup was a disaster in Toronto 2 years ago. I feel like worst case scenario, CFL people just be like, well, you know, it's March. There's a lot of things going on in this. Like, I don't feel like it would the negative press that would come with the Grey Cup being a failure would attach itself to CFL Week if it wasn't as monstrously successful as it would be in other locations. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does, because there's no big event that you can point to and say, oh, they're 10,000 short of a sellout.
Exactly.
Like, this was a huge failure.
There were only 75 people at the combine. No one knows how many people. Like, it doesn't feel like you said, there's no number to point at to go like, oh, look where they failed, where everyone else succeeded. So I feel like it's kind of a low stakes way to drum up support in those locations and make these guys that we know as hardcore fans are superstars, turn them into superstars in locations where they aren't currently being seen in that capacity.
Well, fair enough. I'll agree with that. I will agree with that.
All right. So CFL Week, we mentioned the Hall of Fame announcement. Pretty darn good Hall of Fame class. Scott Flory, Baron Miles, Hank Olesik, Brent Johnson are obviously the guys. Those are some of the – there were others. Frank Cosentino got in. But those four, the players, kind of from our childhood and into our, like, adolescence, maybe even some young adulthood here, are names we know. Baron Miles, I think, is funny because, speaking of the East Final that we're going to talk about in a bit, he was a rookie that year and is in that game, and they talk about him. He was the most outstanding rookie nominee for the East. So in the same week that he gets announced to go into Hall of Fame, we're going to talk about what's essentially his first division final as a player. That's kind of neat. And Hank the Shank, he's one of those guys who I don't remember a ton about because he came about before I was really – well, he started playing before I was even born. But I remember just him being there. I just remember Hank the Shank because he would either boom punts 8,000 yards – or kick him like three. Like, he was very inconsistent. And I just remember everyone calling him Hank the Shank. But it's nice to see punters get some love. And Brent Johnson, I'm glad he got in because his career kind of ended before the CFL really saw this skyrocketing popularity. And I think people who, because he was really big kind of like the early to mid 2000s. And I feel like the CFL really took off once they got like the TSN deal. And then maybe kind of like 2010, 2011-ish is when I feel like we've really started to hit the hump of where we are kind of now, with the CFL being not really seen as a minor league anymore, kind of getting the respect it deserves. I feel like Brent Johnson's career wouldn't get the due it does because he played in that kind of forgotten era a little bit. But man, was he ever a good player. Like, you want to talk about a Canadian defensive lineman who dominated. That's Brent Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the best Canadian defensive lineman that I've ever seen play. He played at Ohio State. He won a Rose Bowl and a Sugar Bowl. Played 11 seasons with the Lions and just had a tremendous career. He was a CFL All-Star three times. The league's most outstanding Canadian twice in 2005 and 2006. And the most outstanding defensive player in 2006. So, yeah, a hell of a career by Brent Johnson, and glad to see him get in.
And didn't he play opposite Cam Wake the years Cam Wake was in BC? Could you imagine? Like, I know everyone's going gaga over Willie Jefferson and Charleston Hughes in Saskatchewan and how great that defensive end combination is going to be. And we know all about great defensive end combinations. Hamilton, you know, Joe Montford always had – he had Tim Cheatwood. He had Gonzalo Floyd. Like, he always had kind of a bookend guy that, man, maybe you can double-team Montford, but then the other guy's going to get numbers. Brent Johnson and Cam Wake on the same defensive line? That must have been nightmares for quarterbacks.
Yeah, that's a scary situation right there. I mean, one of the best Canadian defensive linemen and one of the, you know, you could argue the best defensive lineman to ever play in this league. So, you know, not on his career, based on his career in the CFL, but just what he did in the CFL and then basically doing the exact same thing in the NFL.
Yeah, he's had a very, very productive career in the NFL, Cam Wake, that is. And he was really productive. He didn't have, like, 39 sacks in, like, two seasons. Like, that's insane. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a beast.
He's a monster.
We were lucky to get to watch him play up here for a couple years. Never, ever should have stepped foot on a CFL field, to be perfectly honest. That dude was NFL ready from the word go. But, man, yeah, I always like the Hall of Fame announcements. It's, to me, you get to kind of relive the past. You get to show respect to these guys. The Hall of Fame game is going to be in Hamilton, so these guys are going to be here for that. I liked it last year when they had it here, and I'm glad it's here again. The Hall of Fame's now going to be – they finally announced it'll be ready by the start of the season for people to see in Hamilton, so that's good.
Yeah,
I don't know. The Hall of Fame always kind of – it drums up sort of old memories, and I think that's always fun.
Yeah, and let's not forget about Tom Hugo. I mean, Tom Hugo – he was a hell of a player. Now he's played in the 50s, but
he played before our fathers were born.
Yeah, let's not, you know, we'll mention all of them. We got Tom Hugo.
Of course.
We got who else? We got amateur player Paul Brule, Montreal native, played for St. Francis Xavier, and you mentioned Frank Costantino. I remember that my dad had a book of his. I believe it was. Is it what the Canadian Football League was called, the passing game?
Yep.
I didn't read it, but I remember seeing it around the house.
I think he wrote a number of CFL books, like two or three. I don't think he wrote like 50, but yeah, we used to have the passing game.
Oh, here we go. I got it here.
Oh, there you go.
Costantino authored 17 books on sports in Canada, including three on Canadian football.
Three. There we go. No, he didn't do End Zones and Border Wars, did he?
No, that was Lowell Ulrich, I believe.
Oh, okay.
He's in Vancouver, writes for a paper out there.
Yeah, he writes for Three Down Nation. I'm very embarrassed that I got that one wrong.
You can just edit it out.
Yeah, fair. No, we leave our mistakes in. I'll live with that one. Okay. The other thing to come out of CFL week that I think requires us to talk about are some new rules proposed. There were a ton. They're going to make – again, these are not implemented. These are what have been proposed, although I imagine most of these will be implemented. Blindside blocks are going to be illegal. Low blocks outside the tackle box. There's a whole host of them. But I think the two big ones are eliminating the force-out rule. I think that's finally going to happen in the CFL. But the one that I think everyone's going to talk about is eliminating illegal contact as a reviewable play. And I applaud the competition committee for coming up with that, because I feel like that outside of there's too many challenges, I feel like the illegal contact one was the one that caused all the problems with the fishing expeditions, with the
right.
Here's a big play, here's a turnover, okay, let's there was illegal contact somewhere, let's throw a challenge flag. And because you can find illegal contact on pretty much any play, you knew these big plays were going to be wiped out. Even if they go back to two challenges like they did before, I feel like now we're going to get – if we get this out, I think it's going to flow a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, and it's not, it wasn't a case of one or two teams, you know, having someone, you know, up high looking at every play to see if, you know, if something goes wrong, okay, we saw this on this side of the field. It was every team doing this. So every team was fishing, as you say. And it drove the fans absolutely bonkers. And I was one of them as well. So they did a half measure – like midway through the season last year, making it one challenge per game. And then they can, you know, maybe fit in the other half with eliminating illegal contact reviews. So if that happens, bravo. It'll make the games even better than they are now. And they were really good last year.
And we have a new head of officiating this year. So what I'm hoping comes out of all of this, aside from even rule proposals, is that they get back to having review be what it was meant for, which was to fix, and this is a direct quote from the CFL, fix egregious errors. We saw so many ticky-tack, pass interference, and illegal contact calls that negated plays both in Hamilton's favor and in the favor of other teams throughout the last few years, that it just became where if we're going to have review oversee everything, then just let's let robots in review dictate penalties in the game. Like, just review every play, and then, oh, there's a flag, there's a flag. Like, it got to the point where everything was being sort of micromanaged with reviews. You get rid of this, I think that'll help, but I just, even the rules that stay in, I just want review to fix the, just, okay, they absolutely missed that one. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, I don't need the game to be perfect. I hate to keep talking about what we're going to talk about later, but we watched the 98 East final, and there were some controversial calls in that game, but that's not what you remember, at least back then. You don't remember, oh, that should have been a catch, or oh, that should have been a fumble. you remember the game itself, and over and I feel like recently everything we remember about the games we watch, be they Ticat games or otherwise, we're remembering blown calls, and they're blown calls because we have the technology to fix them and either get it wrong on replay or they blow it and like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like everything's become about what the calls are and not the play on the field. And I feel like if review is used simply to fix the major problems, the major errors, and we get rid of these ticky-tack fishing expeditions for legal contact, stuff like that, I feel like the game will just be better. I can live – and yes, I'm sure you and I are going to sit down here in 8 months or 6 months, and we're going to talk about a Ticat game where a blown call, we're going to be ranting and raving about it. And in the heat of the moment, it happens. You get pissed off because your team loses on what you think was something that shouldn't have. But overall, when we're sitting here with hindsight and with foresight and with rational thought dictating what we're saying, blown calls are going to happen. We accept it. We're not going to be happy about it in the moment, but we accept it as an inevitability. If the games are exciting, then you can live with some blown calls. You really can. Everyone, you live with blown plays. You live with blown calls. That's what I, out of all of this, I just want to see review used for what it was meant for and not to just find, he tripped over his shoelace. That's illegal contact. That negates the interception return for a touchdown.
Right. And you talk about the 1980s final. It's such a different time. Nowadays, if there's a missed call, everyone on Twitter, it's immediate reaction. Garbage, 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 garbage call. You know, what are you doing, CFL? Blah, blah, blah. Back in the day, if there was a blown call, and also in 2017, a million replays from different angles. Back in the day, if there was a missed call, you might see one replay and then on to the next play.
Yep.
People weren't dwelling on it like they are these days. There wasn't that. You didn't have a platform to complain like you do these days. So unless you're calling into the radio stations or whatever, but it's just a lot different. And you know, it wasn't perfect back then, but the flow was a lot better.
Yeah, I think we'll get into that when we talk about the East Final in a bit. But the last bit of CFL news before we get to that, Mike, we got to talk about Marcus Thigpen, our old buddy who's now in Saskatchewan, played many good years for the Ticats, suspended 2 games for taking steroids. That was a bit of a shocker.
It was, because you look at a guy like Thiggy and you don't think steroids. I mean, he's a quick player and he's not a muscle head, you know.
He's pretty jacked. Have you ever seen him like in a t-shirt? He's pretty jacked.
No.
But you know what? Here's the thing. You look at players on the field, and I've seen some players. Like, I've gone to some Ticats fan days, and I've seen players, about town because I live in Hamilton, and some guys do here. And you see them. I don't bother them and be like, hey, how's it going? I just, it's so and so. They're deceptively large, like muscular wise and like height wise. So you look at them on the field and you feel like, okay, they're pretty big. Then you see them out in real world and you're like, holy crap, they're huge. So even a guy like Thigpen, who you don't look at as being like muscly, he's jacked. And he was jacked years ago when he was like, I have a picture of myself with Thigpen, and his arms are just like he's not flexing, but he's got like bulging biceps. Like he was a pretty big dude.
Oh yeah, I'm sure he is. That's not what you think of. No. You know. But that's what it was, steroids, like for sure.
Yeah, it was some anabolic steroid that hasn't been mass produced since like the late 90s. Like he's taken you ever seen Wolf of Wall Street?
Yes. Yeah.
I pictured it when I first heard that he took some steroid that hadn't been produced for like 25 years or something. I pictured the scene where Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill are taking the expired Quaaludes. And they're just popping it because, these aren't kicking in, these aren't kicking in, these are, and they take like 80 of them before they're like slurring their words and stuff. Like, that's what I pictured. He's like, he's taking these non-mass produced steroids, and it's like, oh my God, like what, like is he Quaaluding out like Leo in Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's too bad that he felt that it was necessary to do that. Now, some players, correct me if I'm wrong, but steroids are used for injuries as well, right? Like, it's not just a...
Well, it can be prescribed as a medicine. He's not an athlete, but my grandfather, when he had his cancer problems before he passed away 5 years ago, he was taking steroids now and then to, like, build up an appetite and to help him, like, rehabilitate from being sick. So, like, steroids can be prescribed as a drug to help you recuperate.
Right, but...
But that's not what this was.
No, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing, I guess, if you're a Rider fan. You know, they've had a couple disappointing things in the offseason with players and drugs, but
I mean, you know what about the DeRon Carter thing? He had weed cookies?
Yeah. So the weed cookies thing is interesting because originally it was, you know, he had over 30 grams of cannabis. But, you know, weed cookies, that's different because there's different ingredients, obviously, in weed cookies. There's not just cannabis. So I don't think that would hold up in court if they were trying to go after him for
over 30 grams. Dude, I just ate some before we recorded. I ate about 4 Tim Hortons cookies. And I'll tell you, I probably ate over 30 grams of cookies right there. They were those some hefty suckers, to be honest. So if like, and again, if he's got weed cookies, then yeah, okay, it counts as 30 grams. But cookies have flour and sugar, and did he have chocolate chips in it? Like the prevailing attitude towards marijuana in this country is changing, and I like that. Even though I am not a user, I have I have indulged myself in marijuana in the past. I don't now, not for any puritanical reasons. I'm just cheap and don't want to pay for stuff to get me messed up. I don't drink a ton of alcohol either for the same reasons. No, I'm not against it. I'm not going to go out and buy a 2-4 beer when I can get a case of pop for cheaper and have more money to spend on other stupider things like video games and movies because I'm still a grown child. But
stupider? Is stupider a word?
Stupider is a word. It's in the dictionary. You can Google it when you're done. Stupider is a word. I'm sick of people telling me it's not. It's in the goddamn dictionary. Anyway, I don't see it. He wants to chew on some cookies. He wants to eat some cookies and get stoned. Like, I don't care. And I think we talked about this when he got busted before. We talked about it. I don't care. The attitudes in this country change. It's going to be legal soon. Randy Ambrosi came out and said, like, we're probably going to have to change the way we think about marijuana once it's legal. If you're not going to punish a guy for getting drunk, how can you punish a guy for getting high?
Yep, that's my thoughts as well. And you know, if he has the cookies and the cookies weigh over 30 grams, you don't have to worry about trafficking charges or anything like that, I think. So that's a good thing for DeRon Carter, and it's a good thing for the Rough Riders as well.
Yeah, back to the Thick Pen thing though. This was another area where you and I got a little bit of a spanking for some comments we made online. Daryl Davis, who works for 3 Down Nation, put out an article that talked about punishing teams for players failing drug tests. And I think with hindsight, I could say you and I were probably a little bit harsh on the idea of it. And then I think as we discussed it more with Drew Edwards, who kind of, you know, gave us a little bit of a tongue lashing, if you will, for our comments, we kind of, you know, pushed back a little bit and saw and sort of understood where Daryl was coming from with the idea of teams should have to pay the salaries, but it goes towards a good cause sort of thing. And I can see that. But I think the heart of the matter is something you and I agree with that came from it is I don't necessarily like the idea of teams being held responsible for the actions outside of a team environment that adults do. I don't like the idea of, yes, we have laws and stuff, obviously, but if I decide to get wasted if you lend me your bike, and I made this comment on Twitter, if you lend me your bike and I ride your bike home and I kill someone with it, should you be held responsible because you lent me the bike? I don't think so. I feel like this is the same thing. Just because these guys are employees of the team doesn't mean that the team should be held responsible for the players doing something illegal. I know you kind of agree with me on this.
I do. And I don't know. I was thinking of a kind of an idea as well. Like, what if there's a writer, right? And they take, I don't know, Adderall or something to enhance their performance to finish up that story. Is the newspaper gonna get in trouble for that? Because one of their employees was using drugs to enhance his performance? I don't think so. To me, it's like I look at it like Big Brother type of thing. You know, there has to be freedom of individuals. Individuals make their own decisions, and I don't care if the team is saying get better and get faster and get stronger. That's always gonna be like that. Mm-hmm. In every single realm of employment, you're going to have competition, and people make their own decisions whether or not to cheat or to do it the
for lack of a better word, the right way.
Yes, thank you. Sometimes I just can't spit out words, Josh. You know this, but yeah. So I just don't think that individuals should be policed in that manner. And how are they going to, like, how are they going to police this situation? Like, are they going to have cameras in people's houses? And, like, how far are you going to go with this?
Well, and thing, too, to me, Mike, is I feel like football players are treated as children enough. Like, they get yelled at practice. They get treated, like, as a football player. And, again, I only played as high as high school football. I never played college. I obviously never played in the pros. But I've seen – you see these behind-the-scenes documentaries of training camps. You see guys getting lambasted. Could you imagine if you went to your job and every little mistake you made – you were told stop, do it again, and then increasingly got yelled at work. You tell your boss to go pound sand. Like, yeah. you don't talk to adults that way. You communicate with them in a calm, and you get the point across that, yes, you screwed up, don't let it happen again, but you don't scream at them. I've always thought that if you have to scream at someone to get your point across, you're a very poor communicator. That's my personal opinion. So I think football players are already treated like children. Now we're going to add on the fact that the teams are supposed to be basically parents for these guys and monitor them when they're not at work. That just seems like way too much to me.
Yes, and I can relate to that kind of because I worked in a kitchen for a couple years, and that's a high pressure situation.
Sure thing.
If you don't get out, you know, they're yelling about fries or like you're getting yelled at over garlic bread. And eventually I said, screw this. I am not getting yelled at every day for very little pay. So I can kind of relate to that, you know, not in the same way, but, you know, there was a lot of yelling going on in that time of my life, and I just could not handle that stress.
Well, you said it best. There's pressure in every job. Your job, my job, there's pressure to get things done right. If you started taking cocaine to speed up how fast you did your work and – you know, your boss didn't know about it, and then they found out about it, and you got fired. Is that the company's fault that you have to get this done quicker, you have to get this done faster? And the only way you can think about doing that is I'm going to take speed, so I'm more. You know what? Like, it's not.
Well, yeah, that's what Adderall is basically. Exactly. Like, I watched a thing on Netflix, the documentary on how kids, like college kids, like they all take it, and it's just Adderall is like speed at a lower dose. Yeah, I just don't see how you can babysit grown adults, tell them to make – like, they're going to make their own decisions, and that's my basic argument. It's not a very smart argument. You know, I'm not a very smart person compared to the people I was debating with.
Don't sell yourself short, Mike.
You know, that's just my opinion, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but that's how I feel.
I stand by you on that one. All right, let's get to what we're here for. It's the first ever Podski Wee Wee retro game review. We've teased it enough. Mike and I, this past weekend, we sat down and watched a football game from almost 20 years ago, the 1998 East Division Final, played here in Hamilton at Old Ivor Wynne Stadium between the Hamilton Tiger-Cats and the Montreal Alouettes. I think we should set the stage here a little, Mike, before we start talking about the game. So how old were you in 1998? What were you up to? Generally, what was life like for Mike in November of 98?
Well, I was 13 years old, 1998, so I was just getting over the crushing realization that Bret Hart wasn't in the WWF anymore. That really stung. Goddamn screw job. But, you know, I was into wrestling heavily at the time. I was obviously into the Tiger Cats at the time. I was pumped to be at this game. I had seats underneath the press box, very high up. I remember seeing one of my friends there in the town that I grew up with his dad as well. It was just it was a very exciting time to be a Ticats fan. And to be honest, I watched this game in full, and we'll talk about it at length, but I don't remember anything until like the last couple of possessions. So it was great. What about you?
I was 16. I was in high school. I went to the game also, so this is probably not the first game that you and I both attended, but it's the first one that we know for sure that you and I were both at the same time. We sat on the same side of the field. I was in, I want to say it was box E, about five rows up from field level. They were amazing seats. I got them from a neighbor for $20 each. A playoff game, five rows from the field in a box, $20 per ticket. You couldn't beat that deal. He had them. He had season tickets. Couldn't go to the game. Said to me, and my friend that lived across the street from me, hey, do you guys want to go? We're like, hell yeah, we want to go. We both had jobs at the time, so we could $20. I spent $20 on gumballs that back in those days. I had no problem spending them on a ticket. Like you, totally into wrestling. And what's weird is I have the WWE Network, and I watch it kind of frequently. I've gone back and watched 97, 96. I'm watching 1998. I'm just heading into the King of the Ring, 1998, the old Hell in the Cell between Mankind and The Undertaker. And right. I watch that, and that I'm like, I can't believe this is 20 years ago. It doesn't feel that long. I watched this game, and this game took place about 4 or 5 months after that. And man, was I like, this game was so long ago. It's funny how like different things have you perceive time differently. And this game just, it felt like it was forever ago. And like you, aside from quite literally the last 30 seconds of this game, I did not remember a damn thing from it.
No. And there was a lot of interesting stuff that went on. So, well,
and this was also the first time that you and I had been able to watch it on the television side because we were both at the game. And it's not like back in those days you recorded everything or you could go on demand. Like kids, if you're under a certain year of age, you don't remember how it was. The internet
you
could
barely watch a replay. I mean, they had that old rinky-dink scoreboard at Ivor Wynne at the time.
Yep.
You could barely watch a replay there. It was an interesting time, I'll tell you that.
It was an interesting time. So what are some of your overall thoughts in the game? Because I took copious notes. We talked about this before. I know you took copious notes. Before we get to talking about the game, and I think this is the first time Mike and I have done this, obviously, it's probably going to be a little bit rougher than it should be. We're not quite sure how we should cover it. We're going to try to do our best. We're going to kind of go quarter by quarter and discuss kind of the things we saw. But I want to talk about, like, before the game and just your overall thoughts of the game. I've got some stuff in here. I'm sure you have some stuff. What did you kind of think of this, the game itself and, like, the presentation, just everything about it?
You know, CBC gets a lot of flack for how they covered the CFL back in the day. But to me, it's like, you know, vintage stuff. It's my childhood. You know, you hear the theme music and, you know, the announcers, and it just brings me back. And I fondly remember the CFL on CBC. I just want to say that. But, yeah, I mean – it was a great game. It wasn't 54-50, but there's a lot of stuff that happened in this game that kept you interested. And we're going to talk about it at length, but I thoroughly enjoyed watching this game last night when I put the DVD in the old PS4.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well, which is surprising for a game that ended 22-20. And it was kind of a defensive battle, but it didn't feel like sloppy football. Yes, there are obviously some sloppy plays. There were turnovers galore. There were drop passes. It was what you remember. But the thing that I took away most from it was how different the game has evolved over 20 years. Boy, did the running game ever matter in 1998. In this game, it featured two of probably the two best running backs or two of the best running backs of the time, Hamilton's Ron Williams, and maybe the greatest to ever put on a pair of pads and run the football in the CFL, one Mike Pringle. This was the year Pringle rushed for 2,000 yards. Ron Williams, just looking at the stats going into this game, they briefly, because we had a little bit of the pregame on here, Ron Williams in 97 and 98 had 29 rushing touchdowns. That is ludicrously high. Like,
and think about it. I mean, Danny Mack probably threw a bunch of touchdown passes too.
He did, right? And he led the league in interceptions.
Yeah. Well, like, we scored a lot of points season, I'd have to say.
Sure did. And like Mike Pringle, this was Mike Pringle's eighth playoff game of his career. They had the numbers for the previous seven. He had 947 rushing yards in seven playoff games. Now, as we'll get into in the game, the Ticats shut down Mike Pringle in this game. That's probably a major reason why they ended up coming out on top in this. But think about those numbers. Seven games, nearly 1,000 yards rushing. No wonder this guy rushed for 2,000 yards in a season.
Yeah, those are phenomenal numbers. And, you know, those go back to his Baltimore Stallion days. And I think he played with the Gold Miners for a year.
I just remember him with Baltimore.
I don't
Montreal,
know if he was a star.
And then late
or anything.
In his career with Edmonton.
Yeah, I don't know if he had any impact when he was with the Gold Miners. But for some reason, I think he had a short time with the Gold Miners. But I could be wrong. Well, I'll check it out after we're done recording here.
All right. Another thing that stuck out to me is it was mentioned by Mark Lee that 1998 was the seventh division final that Danny Mack had been in his 9 years in the CFL. think about that for a second. And obviously he would get back to the division final in 99. So in the first 10 years of his career, eight of them ended up with his team in the either the East or West division final. No one talks about – like, everyone talks about – like, right now, Bo Levi Mitchell gets talked about because of all the games he wins. Danny Mac was kind of the Bo Levi Mitchell of his day.
Yeah, and to the extent that he was in championship games and stuff, like, as you look at them as players.
Oh, and, yeah, totally different players.
Totally different. Like, you know, Danny Mac just – yeah, Bo is a gunslinger as well, but he's just not as gung-ho as Danny Mac was. You know, he's not throwing all those interceptions. But, you know, you look at the interceptions, and yes, they're not good. It's not good to throw interceptions, but the guy, you know, won games for the Tiger Cats, and his stats might not be the best if you look at his numbers, you know, throughout his career, comparing them to other great quarterbacks. But to me, I mean, Danny Mac is the man. He won us a Grey Cup. He's the last quarterback to win us a Grey Cup, and he'll always be the man to me.
Did you catch the little bit of Cavis Reed in the pregame?
I did.
I thought that was kind of neat. And then Mike Morreale was on there too. And holy smokes, he looks the same now, but he looked so young back in those days. And the last thing before we start talking about the game that I'd like to bring up is just before kickoff, Glenn Suter, who 20 years ago was doing games on CBC. He's been the color commentator for CFL football for a very long time. He talked about the high winds at kickoff that was at Ivor Wynn and talked about how it'll make things difficult for kicking field goals and how if you kick in one direction, you're probably going to get a few extra yards boost. And knowing what we know and how the game turns out, that turned out to be pretty prophetic on his part.
Yeah, no kidding. And also they mentioned, I'm not sure if it was before the game or right at the start of the game, but Ozzy was hitting from 54 yards in warm-up with the wind. So I mean, that's an interesting comment right there.
Doesn't it make you feel like, okay, this is all a work? Like, this is fake.
Yeah. It's fixed. It's all fixed.
It's fixed. And you know what?
They,
I got to
give gave it away like Bobby Heenan gave it away with
when Hogan
joined the NWO. Man. Yeah.
What side is he on? Yeah, great time.
Yeah.
But I want to give props to Suter because Glenn Suter gets a lot of flack nowadays for kind of being a cliche spouting dinkhole a little bit. He wasn't that 20 years ago. And Mark Lee, holy smokes, he was a hell of a play-by-play guy. This combination, this Suter's not spouting cliches in this. He's really focusing on the play. He's giving you that insight, that ex-player who knows what's going on. Like, this was a really solid commentating duo.
I totally agree. I thought the exact same thing when I was listening to the game. I thought, you know, Mark Lee's really good. They're really good tandem. And, you know, I don't know what Mark Lee's doing these days. Is he still with the CBC? Does he do like the Olympics and stuff like that? I'm not sure, but it would have been nice to bring him over to TSN to get him, you know, maybe pair him with Dwayne Ford or something. But, you know, I'm not a huge Rod Black hater, but I take Mark Lee over Rod Black any day.
Mark Lee works for Sportsnet.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Huh. I swear I haven't seen him in like two decades, but
yeah, I don't watch a ton of Sportsnet. I'll cop to that. Okay, so let's talk about this game a little bit. Starts off, we find out the Ticats won the coin toss, deferred their decision to the second half. That paid huge dividends, as we'll find out later, because they took the ball, or they took the wind for the fourth quarter when they made their choice the second half, and obviously that played a major role in how the game played out. But the game started a little sloppy. There was a lot of two and outs to begin the game. But the one thing that stood out to me is both teams ran the ball on first down on each of their first drives. When's the last time you saw that in the CFL? Obviously, I'm sure it happened last year, but it's like it's so against what we're used to with the gunslinging, throwing it everywhere CFL. Both these teams ran the ball extremely well.
They did. They both of them had great running backs, especially Montreal. Ronald Williams was a bit nicked up for this game, so we maybe didn't see his full potential in this 98 East final. But, both stellar running backs. One thing I noticed, which is kind of a weird thing to notice, but Osbaldiston licking his hands before he gets the punt. You don't see that anymore. And Terry Baker was a licker, too.
Am I blanking? Terry Baker was a licker. Oh, if there's anything that ever needed to be on a t-shirt, that's it.
They're both lickers, and I don't recall seeing it last year or seeing it in the recent past What has happened to the licking of the hands, Josh?
Where did all the licking go, Mike?
Where did it go?
I don't know. That is an excellent observation.
You know, it could be a little bit of a chemical warfare thing, too. You get some of that saliva on the ball, you kick it to the other team, and, you know, they're sick all of a sudden.
Oh, boy. No, that's excellent. Mark Lee commented on how loud the crowd was on the LOS.
You could notice it. You could notice it, eh?
Like, that was a loud-ass crowd.
Yeah, like normally you don't really, you know, feel the crowd as much as through the TV anyways. And, yeah, they were giving it right from the very start.
I have written down here, so that it was early in the first quarter. The Ticats got the ball. They went two and out. They had it in field goal range. They punted to their own five. And Mark Lee says, why didn't Ozzy kick the field goal there? He said his range was 54 yards.
Yep. I have that written down too.
Crazy, crazy stuff. And another thing. So the Owls get the ball on that. On second and eight, they ran the ball. They ran a draw play with Pringle. And yes, Mike Pringle, like I said, maybe the greatest running back in CFL history. Could you imagine in the modern CFL a team running on second and eight? It never happens.
Nope, especially like a draw play like that. I mean, it's a interesting call. I see why they did it. You know, Tracy Ham wasn't really known necessarily for his passing skills, and obviously Pringle was the guy that ran that offense back then, before Calvillo came into the fold. So yeah, I mean, they were a run happy team, and the Ticats were having none of it.
Man, and how good was the Ticats' offensive line in this game? They made mention that they'd given up 15 sacks on the season. Think about that. Yeah. 15 sacks in 18 games. Man, what you wouldn't give for that type of production from the O-line nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what we have to do. Maybe we'll have it this year, though. We got the guys coming back, and everyone knows that we're both really high on this offensive line group. Now, they're not going to do that, but... something close to that would be nice. You know, get a Jeremiah Mazzoli releasing that ball quick like Danny Mack used to. And, hey, we're right back to 98-99.
All right. So 9 minutes into this game, we get our first score after the teams kind of trade two and outs. Ticats pick up their first down of the game about 9.5 minutes in. Very next play, Danny McManus to Doug Flutie, something we got very used to when they were together for a few seasons. Did I say Doug Flutie?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I do that all the time. Darren Flutie.
There you go.
And another thing that struck out to me in this game, I remember how good Darren Flutie was, but oh my God, how good was Darren Flutie?
He was amazing. Yeah, another interesting thing that the commentators talked about was, okay, so Doug Flutie was in Buffalo at this time.
Yeah.
There was scouts from the Buffalo Bills looking at Darren Flutie.
Yep.
Which is interesting. Interesting little tidbit there. But yeah, a beautiful toss from McManus to Flutie. Beautiful catch by him, you know, start off the game, and the Ticats are up 7-0.
7-0 quick, and then the Owls get the next series. A tip pass goes right through Rob Hitchcock's hands, near interception, and then the very next play, Lamar McGriggs intercepts the pass after Tracy Ham got leveled by Willie Whitehead. Big interception, crowd goes crazy, and it's just... You get a touchdown, next drive, you get the interception. Lamar McGriggs, man, that's another guy who kind of gets lost to time. He was a really, really impressive linebacker when he was with the Black and Gold.
Oh, he was fantastic. Like, you remember, like I remember, the standout play, the real big standout players from that team, you know, the obvious names. But there was a lot of great players that you kind of, you know, forget about because it's been 20 years. But yeah, they get that interception. Ronald Williams gets a 13-yard gain. They throw it past Andrew Grigg.
Yep.
He caught the ball with his tippy toes in bounds. It looked to me like that. It was called no catch. I have it written down. Challenge it. Challenge it. Oh, yeah, you can't. You can't do that. But, yeah, I thought it was a catch. The refs didn't. You know, we move on.
Yep, I thought it was a catch, too. We did move on. Then on the very next play, they throw a beautiful screen pass to Darren Flutie. He rumbles up the field, fumbles the ball, but he's called down. Not so sure about that one either. That's one of those ones that I think in the modern CFL gets challenged. So, a couple of controversial calls here.
Yeah, and there's more to come, I believe. But that was an interesting wrinkle they put into the game plan, was having Flutie in the backfield a lot. and then throwing the screen passes to him. And like you said, that was a beautifully executed screen pass. And Darren Flutie had some speed. You know, he's not really known or wasn't known for his speed, but he was a pretty quick dude.
Sure was. Then we see the Ticats go for it on third and short, which is not at all surprising, but they handed the ball off in the backfield. Not a shotgun snap. Danny Mack under center, sticks the ball right in the gut of Ronald Williams, picks up the first down. Could you imagine seeing that in 2018 CFL? Hey, if Calgary did that a couple Grey Cups ago, they'd have been champs.
Yeah, exactly. Don't get me started. But shortly after that, there was a pass to Mike Morreale.
Yep, very good.
Should have caught it, but there was a pass interference call, which I thought was bogus.
Yeah, me too. But I was like, I watched, and like, you heard Suter talking about it, going, no, he goes through the player there, and I'm watching. Now, again, we have to – this was 1998 TV. This video was – it was fun to watch, but, man, is it – like when you get used to HD, holy smokes, watching – videos from the standard definition era of 20 years ago, it's rough. But I watched it. I didn't think that was pass interference.
No, neither did I. But it was called, and on the next play, they handed it off to Ronald Williams, 1 yard TD.
And the Ticats are up 40-0, and they're rolling. Like, again, this is so weird because you're watching the game, you know the outcome, but you're like, they're 14-0 in the first quarter. How did they not run away with this game?
I know. That's exactly what I was thinking, too. We're still in the first quarter.
We're still in the first quarter. Owls get the ball deep in their territory because there was a muffed kickoff I have written down here. But the thing that I noticed at this point, we saw a lot of screen passes in this game, and that's a play that I wish we'd see more of in the modern era.
Yeah, because it just works.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the time, it works. I don't understand why, you know, they don't do it more often. But you can see that there was a lot of similar plays called. You know, like the Ticats ran an out pattern to Morreale at least 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see that it wasn't necessarily a huge playbook that they had. I could be completely wrong on this. I'm just going by instinct by watching the game. But there didn't seem to be a ton of variety in the play calling.
Yeah, no, not really. It seemed like there was a lot of concepts that the team ran, and they ran them well, and that's why they were such a prolific offense. Ozzie missed a field goal here. We saw Orlando Steinhauer nearly get an interception near the end of the first quarter. And the thing that stood out to me is until the very last play of the first quarter, Tracy Hamm had 0 passing yards.
No first downs either for the team.
Yeah, the very last play of the first quarter is when they got their first down. I have it down here. 15-0 Ticats after 1, 7 first downs to 1 in Hamilton's favor, 108 yards of offense to 37 for Hamilton. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is a staggering number right there. So, you know, Climie gets that catch, and it's the first down of the game. And then we move into the second quarter. I don't know what exactly happened, but I wrote down, Pringle can't get nothing.
Yeah, I could probably add a little bit to that.
Okay, go ahead.
The Owls were going for it on 3rd and 2. They handed off 3rd and 2 in the second quarter, and they don't hesitate to hand it off to Mike Pringle. Joe Monford is right there, meets him, stuffs him. They were in field goal range at the time, and in a game that they eventually lost by 2 points, that decision loomed large. But if you're Dave Ritchie, who at the time was the head coach of the Montreal Alouettes, you're thinking 3rd and 2 on their side of the field. We have Mike Pringle, the best running back in football. We're getting this, but Joe Monford, one of the best defensive players to ever play in the CFL, met him in the hole, stuffed him, Ticats ball.
God, those shoulder pads on Monford,
Oh, my God. How did he ever move?
I don't know. It was great, though. Moving on from that, I have written down here that Morreale had a nice first down catch. Next play, Flutie catch in a tight window. Then the Ticats drive got stopped. They punted to the Alouettes, and then controversy
happened. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a play where you could hear the whistle go, like halfway through the play. I believe Hitchcock tackled Tracy Hamm after this whistle went.
Yep.
And that whistle was not blown by any referee. The whistle was blown by a guy in the front row. So
they find the guy pointing him out.
Yeah, and he was kicked out abruptly and shown on TV, which in this day and age, any just like any troublemaking from a fan will never, ever, you'd never see him put on TV, but there he was getting kicked out right on my 30 whatever inch TV.
Well, it's nuts too, because he's sitting in the first row,
yeah,
behind the Owls bench in a playoff game. The first East final the Ticats had hosted, and they mentioned this during the game, since 1989, been almost a decade. And you decide, yeah, now's the time to be an asshole and I'm going to blow a whistle.
And it was loud too, because yeah, you could hear it on the TV.
You could hear it.
So, yeah, a little bit of jackassery from a fan there. You know, you'd expect that from someone maybe a little bit higher up, you know, in the cheaper seats maybe. But I guess you wouldn't get the full effect if you were that far away from the field. So, you know, he gets kicked out early on in the second quarter. I'm sure he wasn't too happy with that. But, you know, it was just a funny thing to see the referee announce it. A fan has a whistle in the crowd on this side. Security, go ahead. Go get him.
Yeah, it was so funny. Weird. So the Ticats had a really good drive here going, I have written down. And Archie Amerson had a huge run midway through the second quarter. Like, this after they got the ball back from the Owls after the blown whistle thing. They hit another pass to Flutie, and we see that he has 100 yards on six catches with the touchdown catch at 6:23 left in the second quarter. And the Ticats are marching down here. They get the ball to the 4-yard line. I'm thinking, man, how do they screw this up? Like, again, we know the final score. So we know they don't score a touchdown here because they kick for 3 to win the game. And if they score a touchdown here, they can't very well get 22 points if they already have 21 off a field goal. So it's like, how did they screw this up? They just get bogged down and they settle for a field goal from the 4-yard line. And they get up 17-0, and it's like, oh, what a missed opportunity there. They really, in the first half of this game, Hamilton really, really dominated Montreal. And this is, we should mention, in the second quarter, the wind was in their face. The Owls had the wind, so they put together this like 6-minute drive here, and it really could, if they would have punched it in for a touchdown, I really feel like this game, we wouldn't have the all-time Aussie kick. This game would have been over by halftime.
Yeah, it would have been, you know, it would have been a blow to the Alouettes if the Tiger Cats went up, you know, 23-0, 24-0, whatever it could have been. But they settle for the field goal, and it's 18-0 late in the second quarter. And this is when Montreal starts to come to life a bit offensively.
Yeah, the long bomb that was nearly a touchdown pass. Is that what you want to talk about?
Yes.
Did you find it? Okay, so Ham throws a bomb to Matt Cody. Cody catches it in the end zone as he comes down. He hits the ground. The ball squirts out. And Glenn Suter argues that it should have been a completion. Now, I don't remember exactly what the standard for a catch was in 98, but in 2018, that sure as hell wasn't a catch.
No, to my knowledge, it's always been you have to survive the ground, right?
Yeah, and
like,
it's
that's what I thought.
He has it. He's jumping in the air, and he has the ball in his hands. And his feet aren't down yet. Then his feet touch, but his body goes down, and it squirts out. Like, to me, that was a clear incompletion.
Yeah, and Suter was saying that he thought it was a fumble or something.
Did the ball cause a fumble? But it was very strange. Like, again, maybe my understanding of the rules from 20 years ago is not as sharp as it should be for us to be able to kind of dissect this game. But that didn't – I don't know. That, to me, wasn't controversial in the least.
No. And I believe on the next play, Tracy Ham overthrew Climie for a touchdown. So that Montreal had to settle for a field goal. So that would make it 18-3. And then they got another field goal before the half ended, 18-6, Ticats at the half.
Yeah, and it kind of felt like at this point momentum was swinging a little bit to Montreal's way. The Owls were able to put together a couple of decent-ish drives at the end to get some points on the board. This was also the time when I first noticed Baron Miles. Like, I know they talked about him at the beginning, but I wanted when they did the starting lineups, but Baron Miles, who we just talked about going into the Hall of Fame, he was in this. He got hurt at this point in the game. They had to take him out. And did you notice who his replacement was?
I did not.
It was Mark Washington. The same Mark Washington that is now the BC Lions defensive coordinator. So it's like, you look at this game, and you know who else played this game? He had a pretty big special teams tackle later, was current Bombers general manager Kyle Walters. So you got Walters in this game. You got Mark Washington in this game. Danny McManus is an assistant general manager in Winnipeg. So you see kind of the guys who used
Steinhauer
to be on the field. Steinhauer is now a coach as well. Like, you see these guys. Like, you can kind of see their progression. And you watch them with like this eye of, yeah, I can kind of see why maybe they'd be like – you know, Walters being that kind of special teams guy, I forgot that he played in Hamilton, to be perfectly honest with you. And then when I saw Walters make a tackle, I was like, that's not – and then they said Kyle Walters, like, oh, that's kind of neat. So it's like all these guys who become kind of coaches and executives in the league, they can be players sometimes.
Yeah, they can be. So Montreal forced a punt early in the third, but there was a play on that drive where Eric Carter knocked down a ball, and Montreal's receiver was on the ground laying down, and Eric Carter kind of stood over him and mocked him or taunted him. And I just thought to myself, that would have been 15-yard penalty.
Oh, like, flag all day.
Immediately in today's football. But
the big thing before we get too deep into the third quarter, though, the Ticats deferred to take the wind in the fourth quarter. That was the big – like we talked about a little bit earlier when it started the game. That was a – like that if you think about it, if everything happens the same way and they're going the opposite direction, I don't think Ozzie hits from 54 to win the game.
No, I don't believe so. No, I don't think so at all. Especially, like, he was having a tough time in this game. If that wind wasn't on his back, it might have been the Montreal Alouettes playing the Calgary Stampeders in the 98 Grey Cup. So.
Very well could have been. Also, something to note is that we get 5 minutes into the third quarter before Hamilton takes their first penalty of the game. Man, I wish – like, that's another thing I noticed. There were so few penalties in this game. I'm not sure what the total ended up being, but it didn't feel like there were a lot of flags thrown.
No, not at all. And you see that more, like, once you get into the playoffs, you know, in modern day, there's less penalties and stuff like that. But that, you know, to have your first penalty in the third quarter, that's unheard of.
And, like, the Ticats, I know they ate a lot of clock in this. They took another 6 minutes, again, going into the wind. So they took time off the clock for the Alouettes. You think all these things, big early lead, eating clock when the wind's in their face so the Owls don't have the chance to use the wind to their advantage. Stuffing Mike Pringle. I have here Hickok leveled Mike Pringle with 4:30 left in the third quarter. Like, they were all over the Alouettes. And then, like, they made this comeback, and it's like, I don't know how this happened.
Yeah, it shouldn't have been close at all. It should have been a blowout. Like, Ticats should have been – it should have been more at halftime. It should have been a bigger lead at halftime, and they should have just kept piling on because, you know, the Alouettes didn't have a lead until very, very late.
Until they scored the touchdown with like 30 seconds.
Yep. Yeah.
Did you catch here at the time too? This I didn't know, that Rob Hickok's dad was the PA announcer at Iverwind Stadium.
No, I did not know that. I did not know that at all. And, you know, Hickok is one of my favorite players of all time. I have a Rob Hickok jersey. But you forget how damn good he actually was. I mean, a Hamilton boy playing that safety position, he was just a beast out there. It was just fun to watch him again.
For a lot of my adult life, I've been pushing and did push for Earl Winfield to get into the Hall of Fame. And we finally saw that happen. Rob Hitchcock's my new – how is Rob Hitchcock not in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have his stats in front of me right now, but just on watching him, I mean, the guy's a Hall of Fame player.
And
I'm sure the stats back it up, too.
Well, I do know one thing. He's the Ticats' all-time leader in tackles. And, yes, that comes with longevity, but it also comes from being a player that played at a high level. He was a top-notch defensive back safety in this league, and then he moved down to Sam linebacker later in his career. He was great in this league for a dozen years. This is a guy that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and I think you and I – need to use this platform as best we can to push for Rob Hitchcock to get in the Hall of Fame, because there's
absolutely
a lot of deserving players. Don't get me wrong. Hitch is one of them.
Hitch is one of them. Yeah, he definitely, you know, and I believe it will happen eventually, but I have no problem if we, you know, start a hashtag or something. Hitch for Hall of
Hitch
Fame.
Hitch for the Hall.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, getting back to the game a bit here. You know, McManus to Morreale. Now, do you remember Morreale getting a lot of flack from Hamilton Tiger Cat fans when he was with the Tiger Cats?
Because
I remember people just not liking him.
I do. I want to know if that had anything to do, because he was what was her name? The swimmer. Oh, Joanne Millar. Millar, and they were this like Hamilton power couple because they were both from Hamilton, and she was an Olympian and he was playing for the Ticats. But I do remember he was kind of fans weren't enamored with him, which is weird because you think the Hamilton boy comes back from the Argos because that's where he was drafted, stars his very first season as a starter with the Ticats, goes over 1,000 yards receiving. Like, you'd feel like that would be a guy that fans would get behind. But, yeah, there seemed to be, like, kind of a love-hate relationship with him. I think we've sort of seen that change over the years. I think people are putting his career into perspective and realizing how valuable he was for the Ticats. But, yeah, I do recall there being kind of a, like, well, like, he's good, but
but he drops the ball. I remember that being the criticism. That
he did have a few drops in this game that he probably should have caught.
But he also had a couple nice catches with it. In the third quarter, McManus to Morreale, 20-yard gain on the sidelines. Right after that, McManus to Bobby Olive on the sidelines for 27-yard gain. McManus got smoked on that play, which doesn't happen very often.
Nope.
Because he doesn't get pressured very often because of his offensive line and his quick release. And then McManus to Morreale again for another for a 20-yard gain. So, I mean, they you know, a lot of points were scored, but there was movement of the ball the whole game pretty much.
There was.
Maybe not with Montreal, but Hamilton was moving the ball quite well.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of where the game turns into Montreal's favor. We get what – it was on the same drive. Ticats are putting together a drive. McManus hits Andrew Greig. Looks like it's going to be a big gain. Ball comes loose. Owls recover. And that kind of feels like the Owls are kind of taking the game back. Now, the quarter ends, the third quarter ends. No one scores. The Owls kind of squander having the win. So you're thinking, okay, maybe they got the ball now. Maybe they have a little bit of momentum, sure. But, man, they're going to be going into the win. The Ticats have got this game. They can probably put this away really early with a good drive in the fourth quarter. But then the Owls kind of start moving to start the fourth quarter. You get some throws to Climie. You get a Matt Cody touchdown to make it 18-13 on a touchdown that – it went right through Lamar McGregor's hands. So it would have been an interception.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, what if? You know what I mean? And Jock Climie had over 100 yards in this game after his catch in the fourth quarter. You kind of forget how good a player Jock Climie really was. I remember him being good, but watching this game, it's like he was easily Montreal's best receiver.
Oh, on this day by far. I mean, the other receivers didn't perform that well at all. He was, you know, I think it's because he just wasn't, you know, he's not a sexy player, you know, he's not making these like outstanding diving catches and these, you know, 60 yard runs, you know, he's just the
dependable.
He's like the Fantuz or the Morreale or that kind of guy. And, you know, I think he's a little bit underrated. I'm, you know, just basing it all on one game, but, I think he is slightly underrated, and Milt always gives him a hard time on the panel. And I think that's not right, Milt. It's not right.
So the Ticats get the ball back. They don't really do much with it. Then the Owls get the ball back. We get a tip ball by Steinhauer that falls right into Hitchcock's hands. Ticats ball. Again, I'm watching this going like, how is this game? Does this game end up being so close and coming down to the last play of the game? On the next drive, Ticats drive it a little bit. Ozzie misses another field goal, and it's like like, seriously, can you write a better story? You get the foreshadowing at the beginning of the game. He can kick from 54 going into the wind. The wind's going to be a factor in this. Then he kind of has a crappy game. Misses a couple of field goals. And this team that could be up by a dozen or so points, all of a sudden it's still a one-score game. You're thinking, like, is this, like, how is this not a work? Honestly. This is wrestling storytelling. This is general storytelling at its best. The guy makes good at the end of the game. It's crazy to me.
Mm-hmm. And you said that Hitch just came up. I mean, Hitch had to like reach back for that interception and kind of bobbled it around a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a hell of a play by him. But right. Yeah. Ozzie misses 38-yard field goal.
And now we kind of get into the nitty gritty of this game where it really starts to like, we remember this game as being really good. And I think for the most part, it was a very entertaining football game. But because of what happened in the last, like, 2 minutes of this game, it becomes that sort of legend game. We get the very first sack of the game. Mike Philbrick gets a sack on Tracy Hamm with about 2.5-ish minutes left. Then that puts the Owls in third and long. Tracy Hamm makes an amazing play to get a first down. Then Mike Philbrick gets the second sack of the game with, like, 1.5 minutes left. You're thinking, oh, man, this is – okay, so this is over. The game is about to be over. Mike Philbrick gets hurt in the sack, and then maybe the funniest thing from this game happens. You posted the video on Twitter. There's this little guy on the sidelines, old little man. I'm assuming maybe he's a ball boy or an equipment manager or something. Mm-hmm. Philbrick's injury. You just see him on the sidelines, and he yells, "Shit!" as clear and loud as the day is long. It was.
And he
kind of
looks at the camera afterwards too, and he's like, "Ah." Oh yeah, I wasn't expecting that at all. But
nope,
neither was I. I had a good chuckle with that one.
So
that was good.
Yeah, that sack leads to the Allison second and long, pass to Climie. Incomplete, he gets up and throws a temper tantrum. And as much as we talked about how great he was in this game, this happens, and I look at it and go, oh, that's why we hate him. Because that's what I forgot that he used to do. Like, what a – like, he is like – he's like a half a second short of lying on the ground like a two-year-old and slamming his fist on the ground, you know?
No, well, he was just saying objection and hearsay to the ref, you know.
And how many times – I know we talked how good the commentators were, but they really did lean into he's taking his 6 bar exam this next
week. Yeah,
it's like he traveled from Ottawa from every game. Like he lived, he did all his bar exams and lawyering stuff in Ottawa and then would drive to Montreal. Like the drive from Ottawa to Montreal is not that far. It's like the distance from like Hamilton to Toronto. Like I used to do that all the time when I went to school. It's like not a big deal, but it's like they really did lean into like he's going to be a lawyer one day. Like it wasn't to the extent of like what we usually see with these guys nowadays, where they'll hammer the same 5 points home 35 times. But it was something I noticed.
Yeah, I mean they were pretty impressed with that, and they wanted made clear to the audience that he's going to be a lawyer, and he eventually became one. So. Good for him.
So
but,
now we kind of get to where our hell breaks loose, right? Like,
here we go.
It's 3rd and 23. There's a minute and 22 left on the clock. The Ticats get a stop. Tracy Ham's looking for someone deep, doesn't find one, runs, and you hear the announcers go, he's got nowhere to go. He's not going to get the first down. He gets tackled. The crowd's going ape, and you're thinking, and at least I was thinking, how was this not the end of the game?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a minute 22 left. How is there 3 more possessions and 2 more scores in this game?
Yeah. What I have written down is how the F do you get 3 possessions in 122? And we know the CFL, a lot of possessions can happen in a short amount of time. But when the game is at, you know, there's high stakes involved, you'd think that Hamilton would do everything in their power to just kill the clock as much as possible.
And they run the ball on first down, and then they get to second down.
Call timeout.
Yeah. Al's call timeout. Makes sense.
Yeah.
They get the ball on second down, and instead of running the ball to take 20 more seconds off the clock, which in hindsight I guess was a good idea because they needed those 20 seconds to win the damn game, they call a bootleg, and then the Al's don't bite, so McManus is out there, and we all know McManus was not fleet of foot, throws an incomplete pass. This seemed to me to be like the only – really bad play call. Like, if you're watching the game live and you saw this happen, you'd be like, why are you calling this play? Run it up
well,
the
I'll
gut
you
and
why.
Punt, you know?
I'll tell you why.
Okay,
I'll tell you why. You just said it. No one expects Danny Mack to do a roll out of the pocket. I know, but if they did, it would have been brilliant.
Yeah,
right?
he would have picked up 7 of the needed 8 yards. He was not, I don't think, he could have been on the complete opposite side of the field with no one around him. I'm not sure he's picking up that first down.
Yeah, you got a point there. But at least, you know, he could have just slid or something instead of throwing in completion. That would keep the clock going, which would
have
helped, perhaps.
But then the Owls they took 15 seconds off the clock. And it's like, that's nowhere near enough time.
Even with the way that the Alouettes have been struggling offensively in
this
game,
it's
still way too much time. And it was way too much time.
And the Owls get the ball at their 20 with a minute 7 left, and they drive 90 yards in 43 seconds to score the game, like to take the lead. And it's just like, I can't imagine what we must have felt like in the state. Like, my heart must have sunk because all those Alouettes fans, there were a lot of Alouettes fans. They showed them in the crowd. They were cheering. You would have seen the bench was going crazy. Like, it must have felt like that place must have been completely deflated at that point.
Yeah, I wish I could remember how down I felt, but like...
But what happens about 30 seconds later kind of makes you forget everything like that, right?
Yeah, and I wrote it down that right before the drive, Ronnie Lancaster came up to Danny Mack and said something to him right before he went on the field.
Yep.
I don't know what he said, but you gotta think it was great because, you know, Ron Lancaster is great. So gave him a little word of encouragement, and Danny Mac went on the field, and the rest is history.
And but even before, you know, he gets on the field,
I just want to mention that I almost had a heart attack, even though I knew the result of the game when Ronald Williams like flubs the kickoff.
Oh my god, like, dude! It's like, can the Tie Cats win anything without it being like heart stopping? Like, can't they just give us a break? It's like, of course he muffs the kickoff, and that allows him to get a few extra yards. It's like it was all coalescing into like, we're gonna give you the worst, and then we're gonna give you the best.
Yeah, like, I don't understand why they didn't kick it. Suter was saying something about they should have squib kicked it, you know, just along the ground.
Yeah, but he was saying that in the sense that if you kicked it along the ground, then the clock would start. And again, my knowledge of CFL rules from 20 years ago isn't as sharp as it should be, but wasn't it always the case, at least I remember in the NFL, it's always the case that when it's a kickoff, the clock doesn't start until someone touches it anyway. So whether he squibbed it on the ground or not really wouldn't have made a difference for taking time off the clock.
No, that's what I thought too, but, you know, he's the expert. So.
And then, of course, we get the drive, two plays that will live in Tie Cats lore. They throw it, pick up some chunk yardage on first down, run it again, get it into field goal range. And you even hear the announcer say, like, well, they have time to go for it again. It's like, nope, Danny McManus is calling on the field goal unit. And then I'm not even sure how to describe what happens next. Mike, you want to try?
Well, I just want to say that I was pretty – shocked that they ran the ball with Ronald Williams on the last play that they had possession. But, you know, they get it to the 47-yard line, Montreal's 47-yard line. That's a 54-yard field goal for Ozzy. Ozzy's missed two field goals from shorter distances in this game. And one
he missed, like the first miss he had, he missed it by a country
mile.
It was so wide left that it was almost wide right. That's how wide left it was.
Yeah, and I was early on in the game. I'm like, because they showed the 40-kilometer winds, and I couldn't remember. I'm like, did Ozzy kick against the wind for the 54-yarder? But that wasn't the case.
No,
he had the wind at his back, and thank goodness he did, because I'm not sure that ball would have went through if he did not. Because I remember watching that play live, and I wasn't sure that ball had the distance. Obviously, it did, and it'll go down in infamy for Tiger Cat fans. 54-yarder by Ozzy, you know, probably the greatest moment I've ever experienced at a football game. Just the crowd going insane. But I'm sure you felt the same way.
Watching it again for the first time in 20 years, the roar of the crowd when the kick goes through the uprights gave me chills. And the call, too.
The call from Mark Lee, it's good.
Talking about it now, Mike, I kid you not, the hair is standing up on my arms. Like, this will be one of those things that I will remember for the rest of my life. And I've said this for 20 years now. I remember the kick going through and hugging and high-fiving strangers.
Everyone, yeah.
People that I never met before that day, didn't talk to during the game because I went with a friend of mine and we conversed. Never met them, like never knew them before, never saw them again. But on that one day, 25,000 Hamiltonians in that stadium were one person. And And people need to remember this 98 Grey Cup run that they lost, unfortunately, the next week to Calgary. But getting back to being the best team in the East came a year after they were 2-16. This team had been in the dumps for a few years. There was always
the greatest record in Ticat history, 12-5-1. Yeah.
And like this was a team that during my childhood, there was always this concern that they might cease to exist. And that was like the way Argos fans felt a few years ago when you never knew what was going on with them. That's how we felt here in Hamilton. And people, I think, take that for granted that we've had our troubles here as well. Saskatchewan's had telethons to keep their team. Like, there was a time when the CFL was in rough, rough shape. And just to relive this moment and to kind of feel like a 16-year-old again, or in your case, a 13-year-old, I can't describe it.
It's special,
it really
right?
is. It's one of those life memories that I'm going to keep with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just sports, but it's not. You know, like that's like for you and your friend, that's such a special thing that you guys shared together. For me and my dad, it was a special thing that we shared together. And like, you know, just the years before, the struggling of the team in the 90s, you know, there might have been a blip here and there where they were okay, but it was pretty rough being a Ticat fan up to that point. And just to be at that game, to feel the crowd, to feel the excitement, to feel, you know, oh, we're going to the show, we're going to the Grey Cup next week, the only word I can use is special. It was a special moment.
Ticats win 22-20. They're off to the Grey Cup. You find out later that day that they'll be facing the Calgary Stampeders. And you and I, Mike, the next time we sit down and get to do one of these retro game reviews, as hard as it's going to be to talk about a Ticats loss, we are going to sit here and we're going to review the 1998 Grey Cup between the Ticats and the Stampeders. I believe that also came down to a last-second field goal, and I also remember it being a really close game.
Yeah, I believe it was a Grey Cup classic, if I remember correctly. And just one more note on the Aussie kick. Right after that, he got piled on.
Oh, yeah.
He got injured, his knee. I believe he played in the Grey Cup the next week.
He did. Another thing that I want to touch on, did you see the interview with – it was on the video. Did you watch all the post-game stuff as well?
I watched some of it.
Did you see the Rob Hitchcock interview?
No, I did not see that.
He has
I had to go to bed, so I turned it off pretty
right
much.
At the end. He's got maybe a 30-second interview, and the smile on his face said it all. It was a perfect sort of ending to this game where you can just tell – how elated he is that, holy smokes, my hometown team, we're going to the Grey Cup. Like, it's just, again, I'm getting chills thinking about it. It's just such a cool moment for a guy that, you know, lives and breathes Hamilton to get to represent your team in the Grey Cup. That's got to be an amazing feeling.
Yeah, it's always nice to see that the players really care about the team and the city. And it's hard not to for him because he's a Hamiltonian. But I remember when Morreale and Hitchcock retired from the Ticats, and they were both in tears. The Ticats meant the world to them, and you know, we should really appreciate both those players for the, you know, there's Morreale's still around the team. He does his thing. I don't know what Hitchcock's up to, but I'm sure he keeps a close eye on the Tiger Cats as well.
Hitch for Hall. Let's get it trending on Twitter, Mike.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. So that's it for this week's Podski Wee Wee. Let us know what you thought about the retro game review. Let us know how you think we can be a little bit better with this, what you want to hear about us talk about when we do these retro game reviews. We're kind of in uncharted waters here trying this out for the first time, but we do this so you guys can listen and maybe go along for the ride with us. But if you think we could do things better, what parts did you like? What parts did you not like? You can always hit us up on social media or in the comments section on 3 Down Nation. So Mike, where can they find you to give you their thoughts on what we did today?
Mike_Ticats.
And you can find me at JoshSmith_82. Of course, you can always hit us up on the @PodskiWeeWee account, both on Instagram and on Twitter. Like I said, throw those comments into the comment section on 3 Down Nation. I'd love to get some feedback on this. It was a lot of fun to do. It was a lot of fun to watch the game. Mike, it was a lot of fun to talk to you about the game. But if there's any ways that you guys out there, we do this show for the listeners. So if there's any way that you think that we can improve on doing this in the future, please do not hesitate to let us know. And don't forget that you can pick yourself up some of our merch over at our merchandise store, shop.spreadshirt.ca/podskiwee. We got some cool stuff up there. No one has yet bought a Mike Ticats t-shirt. Please, someone. Just
anybody.
Anybody. I want Mike. There to be someone out there wearing Mike's name on their chest. Please.
Hold on, do me a favor. I'll call my mom.
So that was episode 104 of Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.
Thanks for listening. Find more great shows like this at CF Pod Network on Twitter.